Hi, my name is Michael Evans. It's August 13th, 2020. I am located in Juarez, Mexico, Juarez, Chihuahua, and I'm talking with my partner and good friend, Nick Paz.
Hey, my name is Nick Paz. It's August 13th, 2020, and I'm in El Paso, Texas, and I'm talking to my brother, Mike Evans.
Okay, so I guess my story is a little complicated, so maybe we should run through the story real quick so
how did
you guys can understand.
Let's get a cigarette out. It's gonna be a long talk, you know what I mean?
I can do that.
Where did it all start? Where were you born at?
Okay, so I was born 3 hours outside of Juarez, in a little pueblo called Casas Grandes. When I was born, my name wasn't Michael Evans, it was Lorenzo Hugo Nunez Fernandez. When I was born, my father had cancer, terminal cancer, and he died when I was in May of the same year. So I was maybe, I don't know, 2-3 months. My mother was really poor, not like American poor, but like Mexican poor, where she didn't have any money, any food, anything. She didn't. She just didn't have enough money to put shoes on my feet. So she left me with my grandparents on my father's side of the family. And she came to the United States illegally, looking for a job, looking for opportunity, looking for better work. And, you know, after bouncing around for a little bit, she found a job with a professor at UTEP, doing in-house nanny stuff, cleaning, taking care of her adopted daughter, you know, just doing like Mexican nanny stuff, basically. I think she was getting paid like $70 a week. So my mother asked the lady, she's like, is it okay if I bring my son down here to live with us? And the lady gave her permission. So she had to kidnap me from my grandparents because they didn't want to give me up. They were raising me like their own child.
How old were you?
Let's see. She probably left me when I was a year and some change, and then she sent for me right before I turned 3, I think. Now you gotta remember, like, this part of the story I just go off, I don't have that memory. So there's been a lot of different had to grab pieces of my story from different people to get it. So I don't exactly remember the exact age, but I think I came over to the United States when I was 3. So like
what year was that though?
It had to be in 1981, right around there. So when I first came over, Spanish was actually my first language. But when I came over here, I eventually forgot it, right? So anyway, so I came over. My mom had to, like, kidnap me from my grandparents. My mom sent for me. Her sister had to, like, kidnap me from them. She said, hey, can I borrow him for a day? And she took off running, got on the bus. She had to give me sleeping pills, slung me across the border. My grandparents actually gave chase, my grandfather, and he was going to take me back. And they found out where we were living. And my grandfather told my mother, she's all like, hey, let me have him, because my grandmother, like his grandmother, she really wants to see him. And my mother had that feeling that if I give my son up to to his grandfather right now, I'm never going to see him again. So she took off. My adopted mother had to step in, had to intervene, and El Paso said, look, we're not going to let you take the kid back, and if you don't leave, you got to get out of here. Now, my grandfather was kind of a big deal, and he's a stubborn man, and he didn't want to take no for an answer, but his best friend was with him and said, look, if you don't get out of here, they're going to arrest us. You're not in Casas Grandes. You're not a big deal here. They're going to put us in jail. So they left us with, they left me with my mother then. So we were living with the lady, her daughter, and my mother. And, the lady got a job offer at, USC, University of South Carolina. And she offered.
This is the professor that your mother was working with.
Right. So she gets a job offer at the University of South Carolina, and she offers me and my mother to go with her. So my mother was like, yeah, well, you know, we'll go with you. And she was up. So like when we go over to South Carolina, there's no Mexican people over there. My mother is not happy. She doesn't have any friends. There's a lot of racial tension, which I didn't understand back then. Because, you know, like, you know, when you're a kid, you don't really understand, like, racism and this and that and the other. You're just a little innocent kid. And my mother found out she was pregnant. So she went back to the Southwest. She came back to El Paso, I believe, to like sort some things out. Now my mother was having a hard time. She was staying in shelters. Again, she was poor. She didn't have any money. She was really struggling. And the professor said, look, if you leave your son with me for an extended amount of time, I want to adopt him. You know what I mean? Like, go ahead and take your time. I will send him back to live with you if that's what you want. But if you don't think you can handle him or you know what I mean? Like, I'll give him a better life. I'll offer him to make him my son. He'll still be your son. He could visit you in the summers and on Christmas sometimes and blah, blah, blah. But if you don't think you can take him on again, because she's about to have twins now, my brother and sister, if you can't take that burden financially, I will adopt him. So my mother battled around the idea for a while. And in 1984, I was 6 years old. My mother gave the okay for the lady, the professor, to adopt me. So in 86, my mother, this is where my memory like starts being clear. I remember my mother, well, she wasn't my adopted mother yet. I remember the professor, she tells me like this. She says, look, you're gonna grow up here as an American kid. You're gonna go to American schools. You can have any name you want. I want you to have an American name because with other American kids, you're just gonna have an easier time. And I was just like, you know, you hit somebody, especially a kid, you hit somebody with that question. You're like, I don't know what name I want. I never thought of it. So I remember I was watching a movie and I was in love with this girl in this movie. And the hero, it's the movie ever though. It's the movie ever. Like, and I hate saying like when I tell this story, it's just a ridiculous movie. But in the movie, the guy's name was Mike. And the girl, it was Michelle Pfeiffer. Oh man, she was so beautiful. And like in the end of the movie, he got the girl. So my mother was like, that's a good name, Michael Evans. So she kept the middle name the same. So I remember clearly, I remember this is just a very clear memory in my head. I remember the judge saying, okay, Michael Evans is going to be your son, and his name is officially changed to Michael Hugo Evans, and he slammed the gavel. And from that day, it was October in 84, I was adopted.
So you were adopted, and why are you not considered a citizen?
Okay, so I was adopted in 1984, and the laws were different. If I was adopted in 1986. I would have automatically been an American citizen, but the laws don't go retroactive. So when I was adopted, we got my residency, and even how we got my residency somehow complicated things later on because I got it through, amnesty. Reagan was president. I still don't really understand that because, immigration laws are a little complicated. Right. But since I was adopted in 84 instead of 86, I was never considered an American citizen. So anyways, I was living with my adopted mother and visiting my biological mother in the summers and sometimes on Christmas and stuff like that. And we were moving around. We moved from South Carolina. We went to Dayton, Ohio, spent a lot of time in Dayton, Ohio. And then we moved up to Toledo, Ohio. Dayton, Ohio was an awesome place for a kid to grow up, you know, like live by a military base. It was kids from everywhere. Some of my friends were like it was everything. Puerto Ricans, blacks, whites, Asian dudes. Like it wasn't a thing. But when I when I went to Toledo, it was like the very first day of school. I remember I was already messed with because I was Mexican. And I don't even really look Mexican. When I'm here in Mexico, they were like, are you Mexican? I'd be like, yeah. But over there, they just, for whatever reason, they just picked up on it right away, and they were just all like, what's up, Holmes? And they just automatically started messing with me, and I started getting into a lot of trouble. I almost dropped out of school. I was all like, I told my.
But you started your entirety of school, like primary school in the United States, right?
Yeah, my whole like from kindergarten till the very end till some college, everything was. I don't remember Mexico like as a kid. You know what I mean? Obviously now it's a different story, but as a kid, I the only thing I remember Mexico is when I used to go visit my grandparents. I have one vague memory, and I don't know if it's from like when I was born there or from after, but I just remember like dirt floors and stuff like that. It's a really vague memory, but and I can't place it when exactly I remember it from. But from I don't know, 2-3 years old on, I was living in the States. I don't have an accent, and I've completely forgotten my Spanish. So
where'd you get this accent from? Some will call it Jersey Shore.
Ohio, I guess Ohio. Just living like we grew up in South Carolina. We do like I got a lot of fam. We got family and from Boston. We got family in D.C. We got family in Maryland. We got all over Ohio, Tennessee. Like my adopted family is American.
What I'm getting at is that you spent your entire childhood in American schools around our customs and cultures. Like you're culturally American is what I'm getting at. The only difference is
I'm American. I'm American. I'm a more American than like most Americans I know. I know a lot of Americans that wouldn't even think of joining the military. You know what I mean? Screw that. You know what I mean?
Like, So you're in high school, right?
Uh-huh.
You're around that time where you're about to graduate. What gravitated you towards joining the Marines?
Okay. So check this out. When I was in Toledo, I was getting in trouble, right? I almost dropped out of high school. I told my adopted mother, by the way, I forgot to mention her name. Her name is Dr. Evans, so I could like refer back to us both, right? I told her, I said, look, I'm not going to go to school anymore. I'm about to drop out. And she was like, absolutely not. And I was all like, well, we got to work something out. Cause I'm not going to go back to this school anymore. Like I'm just not going to do it. I'm talking, there was like, I was like really bad trouble, drugs, fights, like every possible mistake a teenage kid could make. You know what I mean? Short of like prison time, I was making. So my mother was all like, okay, well, let's figure something out. So I went to go visit my biological mother that summer. And I was a junior. I was about to be a junior. And she was all like, okay, if you're not going to go to school back over there, like it was a long fight. My mother did not want to take me in. I was a pretty bad kid. And we worked something out with my adopted mother and my biological mother. She said, okay, he could finish school over here. So in my junior year, I started finishing school here in El Paso in Canotillo, Texas. School here was completely different. I think I missed one day of school in the last 2 years of my last 2 years of high school, which is, awesome attendance. I graduated on time. Now, like towards the end of my high school, you come to a point like in American culture, there's a point, at least back then, when you're 18, you got to get out of the house. Mom's not going to, you just can't be a bum and stay at mom's house. Does that make sense? Yeah. So I wasn't going to be that dude. So like you can go to school, you can join the military, or you can get a job. But getting a job is really hard without job experience. You know what I mean? Where I'm going to work at, like Chick-fil-A or Taco Bell or, whatever the case. Hold on real quick.
Yeah.
Okay. So I was actually shopping for recruiters. I already had the Marines in my head because, one, they were supposed to be physically the most challenging, right? So I've always been into working out and just, like testing myself physically. So I had them in mind, but I talked to the Navy, I talked to the Army. I think the only one I didn't talk to was the Air Force. Air Force just didn't interest me. talk to the Navy guy. Like, you're probably going to be stuck on a ship for 6 months. I was like, yeah, I'm not really into that. You know what I mean? I think I would go crazy. And the Army, you know, looking back, maybe I should have joined the Army. I don't know. Because I got a lot of friends that are Army vets, and they told me a lot of good stuff about it. Either way, I ended up joining the Marines when I graduated high school. I was the first one to sign up on the delayed entry program. There was five of us. After I did it, like, my friend did it, and then one of our friends did it, and then them two did it. And so there was five of us total, and like, we all went to a boot camp together on the buddy program.
So the delayed entry program is when you're in high school and you sign up, and then once you graduate, you go to basic, right?
Right. So before you even graduate, you sign pretty much an intent to enlist, and it's a contract, and they set a date, and then we're like, well, what day you want to join? And I was all like, again, this was my idea, not theirs. I was all like, I want to enjoy my summer, and then I'm ready to go at the end. So I at September 22nd, they took all of us to boot camp.
Do you remember if, because it's been so long, I still don't remember the conversations with my recruiter. Did the recruiter ever bring up your citizenship at any point?
Okay. So he brought it up on a couple of different levels. One, he said, I they all say it's an easier path to citizenship. Okay. It's not true. I mean,
but you didn't know this at you didn't know this at the time.
Didn't know, and it wasn't really okay. You got to understand my mindset. Like, I never, ever thought that I would be deported. You know what I mean? It was never an inkling in my thought process, because I always looked at myself as an American. So that type of thinking was just never even in my mental state. You know what I mean? So, never in my decision-making was that even a thing. So even though he said, it's an easier path to citizenship, it wasn't it, like, I was like, okay, whatever. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter. But like, the one thing that it did affect, I scored really high on the ASVAB, really high. So they were like, look, man, you scored so high, you qualify for every job in the military, but you're not American. So like, your list goes from like this big to being this big. You know what I mean? So instead of anything with any kind of security clearance, you can't have that job. And your list goes from, like, you know, all of this down to this. You could be a cook, an admin, you know what I mean? Like, it was so, all right. So that was a little
disheartening.
Yeah, it was disheartening. You know what I mean? So that kind of sucked. And then then it comes up again in boot camp, where they were like, testing intelligent people. They were like, hey, you can test for this. They would pull people out when they're taking classes. They were like, okay, Evans, this guy, let's go ahead and get you tested, because you tested so high on the ASVAB. We want to test you so you can get a high-speed intelligence job. And then they were like, oh, wait. No, you weren't born in America. You got to get out of here. Go back to the barracks. You know what I mean? That type of, you know, that's the only time it really came up.
It's like a lingering thing throughout. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So anyways, I was an admin, and like, supply admin, 3043. I was always in the computer, in the office, logistics, everything.
Where were you stationed at?
I was stationed in Camp Pendleton, California for all my four. And the reason I was all there all my four is because I had three knee surgeries. So my first knee surgery, I had my first knee surgery when I was 19 years old, I think. Let's see, I joined when I was 18, I turned 19. It might have been right when I turned 20 or right when my 19 ended, but that was my first knee surgery. So I had three knee surgeries, two really serious ones, and one was, you know, like, not so bad.
What was that moment like when you're done with basic and you're crowned the title of Marine? Like, did that have any significance to you, your family, where you came from?
It had more significant. Okay, we were the first boot camp, the first platoon to graduate on the Crucible. I don't know if they're still doing the Crucible, but it's like, it was this new training regimen they were doing where it's sleep deprivation, food deprivation, and you got to do a bunch of obstacles and just all kinds of like really hard training. You're tired. They'd be like, the drill instructor would be like, all right, go ahead and get some sleep. And you just shut your eyes and immediately fall asleep because you're exhausted. And like 3 minutes after, they'd be like, all right, let's go. And it was that type of stuff. Okay. So at the end of the Crucible, like I said, we were the first squad to get put through that. When you climb up Mount Mother, that's what they call it, at the end of boot camp, you're at the top of the mountain. And it's a good climb. It's a monster climb, right? Like, you got all your gear. It goes up. It flattens out. It goes up. Flattens out. Goes up. It's a monster climb. Not everybody may. I think one or two dudes fell out. I mean, it's not that bad, right? But yeah. So we make it to the top of that, and once you're on the top of the mountain, that's where they give you your EGA, your Eagle Globe and Anchor. And it was like just a crazy proud moment. Like some people were crying. You know, some people were holding discipline and just, you know, standing strong. I was like, you know, it's just that oh shit moment. I'm a Marine, you know what I mean? And that's where they deem you that. So it was just a really good moment for us, man. Like for all of us to go through that together, man. Especially with four other friends from my high school, all of us to go through that together. It was an awesome moment.
How did you enjoy your time in the service? Like what was that experience like for you?
There was like everything else. There was some stuff I liked about it, and other stuff I didn't like. You meet some awesome people, but it's a job, so you meet awesome people and you get to have awesome experiences, but you also have to work for some assholes. You know what I mean? So yeah. It was definitely an awesome experience. Like my adopted mother told me when I told her I was joining the military, she was like, "Well, what are you going to join?" I told her I'm going to join the Marines. And she was like, well, the Marines make a man out of you. So there was a clear difference that my friends told me from high school to post-military, right? Or just even post-boot camp and all that. They were like, Mike, before you were high school, you were a little bit shyer, quiet, timid. And they said, after, you just this, boom, extrovert, and you got confidence. And, you know, so it just completely changed who I am.
You were talking about post-military. Prior to you getting out of the service, what influenced your motives to getting out of the Marines?
Oh, my knee was jacked up. My knee is still jacked up. I opted not to have surgery on my left knee because I got out when I was 22 and I had already had three knee surgeries. Yeah. I can't run to this day. If I try to run, I'm going to be paying for it the next 3 days. You know what I mean? And sometimes I can't even like walk right. So like, yeah, there's no way I could have stayed. Honestly, looking back, I probably shouldn't even been accepted because my feet and my knees are so bad. So I don't know. So that was the, like, just the main motivation is get out, get it. I just do your four and get out. I can't do it. You know what I mean?
So I know, my time when I transitioned out of the Army, I had a hard time like just assimilating into society. Did you experience that?
My thing was,
what'd you go back home to?
I went back to El Paso. To El Paso. Okay. And things, I mean, it wasn't easy. You go from like a super structured life. Cause I had a, you know, a decent, never got in trouble really when I was in the military. I was good to go. I was always doing what I was supposed to do. And, when I got out of the military, I guess that structure going back to, you know, like being free, not having somebody be like, all right, this is boom, boom, boom. Like I'm ADD, so I have a little trouble focusing, and I have a lot of energy. I try to go to college, And I did a year at UTEP, and it just wasn't for me. And like eventually, like when I was trying to juggle a lot of stuff. I had a job, I had my friends, I had school, and you know, I was doing all this stuff, and then all, like, I don't know where exactly, but I started just picking up back into the drug stuff like I was in high school, and it just started, like, creeping in, and then next thing you know, I'm just a full-blown junkie again. You know what I mean? So, not junkie like heroin junkie. I'm just talking about, you know, like just escaping. You know what I mean?
You're constantly. Just numb.
Yeah. Just numb all the time. Just didn't want to be here, kind of. You know what I mean?
You were just trying to figure out your place in the world, but you just couldn't really set the puzzle right.
Yeah, maybe there was a little bit of that too. I mean, that's every stage of life. You know what I mean? Like, I'm kind of going through that now, about, you know, just putting which direction to go to and stuff like that. So when I got out, like I said, I picked up, started getting in trouble again. I overdosed, man. Overdosed on everything, you know what I mean? I took, and I ended up in the hospital. I couldn't pee, man. So like my body was shutting down, couldn't urinate. I went to the hospital. I don't know about. I guess I was in there like just a half a day. They had to put a catheter, but they were like, "Look, man, if you would have waited any longer to come in here, you'd have probably been dead." So it was really close, man.
It's a sobering moment.
Yeah, definitely was a turning point. When that happened, I mean, I was really close to death, and I was just like, "Yo, that's it. I'm done. I'm not. I got to change some stuff up, or I'm gonna end up in a box, right?" So I started changing things up, and I got a job. I got a new girlfriend. I got my head on straight. Right. And I was getting stuff done that I needed to do. And one of the stuff that I needed and my mom was really pushing for was me to get my citizenship, my biological mother. We started to do that. She was helping me get my stuff in order. I passed that, the test and everything. The tests are ridiculous if you grew up in the United States. You know what I mean? Like it's
the test.
Yeah. There was they just asked me questions, and I was like, "Are these real questions?" And they were like, "Yeah, but you got to understand that we're talking up people that haven't grown up here." So I passed that, flying colors, just did everything with a breeze, paid all the fees, and I got accepted to be a citizen. You know what I mean? So I was close. I got my swearing date and everything.
So this whole time, like you went through the whole process properly in order for you to become a citizen. You were adopted properly. Everything. You went into the military as a permanent resident.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So
all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed. I was good to go. Like I had my swearing date. I knew the judge's name that was going to swear me in. I was 27. I just turned 27. I remember when I turned 27 because I told my girlfriend at the time, I was all like, "Hey, you know, I feel like something bad is going to happen to me." I swear to God, I told her that. She was like, "Why you say that?" And I was like, "I don't know, man. I just feel something coming, like a train on the tracks that you can't stop. I just feel it coming." You know what I mean? Yeah. 2 weeks after my birthday and 2 weeks before my swearing date, I get arrested from the FBI, the feds. The feds come knocking on my door, guns drawn. On my day off of work, I was just ordered a sandwich from this takeout spot. I was watching like some fight tapes, and the feds come in and they were like, "Put your hands up, And I was all like, "Yo, what did I do? What did I do?" Right? Like I hadn't done anything in forever, you know what I mean? Like, and they were like, "You remember what you did?" They threw out some names, and they were like, "This is something that you did 18 months ago, and when I was, you know, when I was doing drugs and selling drugs and stuff." And they were like, "You remember this and that?" And they put a couple of names together, and they cuffed me up, and they took me to prison, man. And like, I get a letter in the mail saying, "If you've been arrested from this day to this day, you can't swear in." So, Like, so I start doing, I get arrested. They throw me in county. They let me off on bond because they didn't deem me a flight risk, but they weren't supposed to do because I'm not a citizen. I wasn't a citizen. So I started going through the like pre-trial process. I didn't know anything about the system and I'm scared. You know what I mean? That they're because I don't, for whatever reason, the prosecutor was really gunning after me. Like if you saw her demeanor in the court and with everybody else. And then to me, like it was completely different. Like she was really gunning. She wanted to max me out. So, but me, like, not knowing the system, I'm scared. I'm not exactly a kid, but you know what I mean? I'm not, like, some hardened career criminal either that's been in and out of the system. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I was scared that they're going to put me away for 10 years or something like that. So, instead of getting a criminal lawyer, I got a immigration lawyer because I was all like, look, I'm going to have to do some jail time, right? I'm gonna have to accept it. I'm gonna eat that. Like I accept what I was doing in my past when I was, you know, on that whole thing. I'm wrong for that. I understand that, right? But I don't want to get deported. Now you're talking about what is in the early 2000s. You know, like it was just the craziest stuff. Like people didn't even want to come over here to visit. People were dying left and right. People getting their heads chopped off. Like it was. It's just so bad. People hanging from bridges and stuff.
It's around the time when they declared their war on drugs. Yeah.
Right. Kinda. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So I get a immigration lawyer, supposedly the best immigration lawyer in El Paso. And I start going through my pretrial stuff and what's crazy, so we don't have a lot of money. I don't have enough money to get an immigration lawyer and a criminal lawyer. And I thought that was the best move, which looking back, I should have done it in reverse, right? Because the immigration lawyer didn't really do anything. He just kind of just took our money. But the criminal lawyer, when I was doing my pretrial stuff, he's all like, look, man, here's a plea for 18 months. He's all like, this is a good deal. You're not going to get a better deal. He's like, I suggest you sign it. So I was all like, oh, 18 months? That's not a lot of time. I was like, I signed it. He calls me up 2 days after I signed it, and he was all like, hey, look, we can't give you the 18 months, but you just signed that you're guilty, right? You signed that you're guilty with this plea bargain. You signed. If you try to fight that, they're going to give you more time. So now that you signed that you're guilty, you just got to kind of take whatever they give you. You know what I mean? So
it's through intimidation of the state that you just had to sort of take it on the chin. What did they eventually give you?
Eventually they gave me my total sentence. They were trying to give me, like the prosecutor, like I said, she was gunning for me. She was trying to give me like 8 years. The judge, the same judge that was going to swear me as a citizen is the same judge that sentenced me, which is a bit ironic, right? And he was all like, look, in the sentencing, he's like, I'm not going to give him the max, but I'm not going to give him the minimum either. He's all like, I'm going to give him somewhere in between. They ended up giving me 52 months, right about 4 years. So during this time, we're also fighting my immigration case, and the lawyer applied for a, American passport. And his argument was that we're American. Well, that I'm American, that I'm American citizen because of my adoption, because my mother, my biological mother naturalized when I was seven, before I was 17. That should automatically qualify as a citizen. She was my legal guardian. I was living with her when she naturalized because of my service, because of just all the stuff that I had positive going for me. It should be a layup basically. Well, they hit me back and they were like, because I'm adopted, I can't get the benefit from my biological mother because I was adopted in 84 instead of 86. I can't get that as a, you know what I mean? Like there was a bunch of, because I was in the Marines from 96 to 2000 and I didn't serve for the extra year when 9/11 hit. I there was just a bunch of complications in these times where I just missed it. He was all like, that's why you don't qualify to be American because you've got all these little loopholes. And like we could fight it, but it's going to cost a lot of money, and you're going to have to take it all the way to Supreme. And it's not like you could just go and say, hey, I want to fight this in Supreme Court. Like, you got to go through steps. You got to go through, you know, like this court and that court. And he's like, it's going to be a lot of money. So we just didn't have that kind of money. So I just, I ate the time and I went to jail. And we even tried again. My adoptive mother got another lawyer when I was at the end of my sentence. We got another lawyer out of Dallas and tried to fight the case that way. And again, it just didn't happen. So,
where did you do your time at?
They switched me around a lot. I went to, like, I started my time in Latuna, and then they switched me to Siegelville. They switched me over for the drug program. But when I was in the drug program, is when I found out for sure I was going to be deported. So I quit the drug program because Mexicans can't get any time off for the drug program. You're not a citizen. You're not going to get to go into a halfway house and stuff like that. You know what I mean? So after Siegelville, and then I went to a place where Eden, and then the last place was Hasbro. I did four prisons in 4 years.
And this is all federal time?
All federal time. Okay.
So you get released from prison, but you get picked up by ICE, right?
Right.
Okay, so what was that process like, and how long did they keep you?
Well, that was the last place that you're at, and that's where you fight your case, and you go in front of this video judge, you fight it there. I mean, they keep you. I don't know. I was supposed to be in there longer because I was supposed to appeal my case, right? Yeah. Let's see what happened. Okay, so I was supposed to be in there longer because I was appealing my case in the ICE place. That was the last prison I was at was Haskell. I remember the morning I got deported, I don't remember how long I was there. I had a job there, and I was watching like some videos and getting ready to go to work. And the guard comes in and he was all like, "Hey, Mike, get your stuff together. You're getting deported today." And I was like, "There's no way I'm getting deported today. I'm appealing my case." And he's all like, "Look, I'm not supposed to show you this list, but you look at this name. Your name is on that list. You're getting deported today. If you need to make a phone call," like, we were cool with some of the guards there. He was like, "Go ahead and use my cell phone. Go in the other cell over there, the empty cell, and use a phone and call somebody." So I'm calling my girl, and, you know, I'm like, "Hey, I'm getting deported today." And she's like, "Guys, stop playing with me." And I was like, "Hey, call my mom, call the lawyer, blah, blah, blah." So everybody's freaking out. My mother owed some minute amount to the lawyer that we had in Dallas, and he never filed for the appeal. I got deported. I got all my stuff together. I went to like the holding cells. There was two holding cells, one for girls, one for dudes. And they pulled me out of the holding cell and they were like, "Look, you got to sign this paper." I was like, "I'm not signing that paper." And they're like, "You have to sign this paper." I was like, "I don't have to sign shit." You know what I mean? And they were like, "It's basically signing a paper that says that I agree to my deportation." And I was like, "I'm not signing that." And they were like, "Give us a fingerprint." I was like, "I'm not giving y'all nothing." And they were like, I get four ICE agents that surround me. Like, I'm talking there. One's in my face, two on the sides, and one's on my back. And the head guy, he was all like, "Look, if you don't give us a fingerprint, we're going to break your fucking hand and make you give us a fingerprint." Exact words. And I was all like, "Look, I tell you what, man, if you guys give me one more phone call, let me call my girl." He's like, "But you can't tell him where you're getting deported to. You can't tell him, you can't give him any information, what time, any of that." He's all like, "But if you give us a fingerprint, then we'll let you have a phone call." So I give him my pinky print and I call my girl and my sister to meet me up where, because I had already talked to him before, and they were going to meet me up, drop me off some money and clothes, and they put us all in the bus and just dropped us off at the line, huh? They dropped me off in Acuna, Texas.
Did you talk to the judge at all during this process? Like, did the judge, or I don't know the process of it, but did any judge have any sentiment over you because you were a Marine?
Yeah, there was uh, there was a judge named Judge Rogers, but their hands are tied. They were like, there's nothing we could do. You can't go here. You can't go there. You know what I mean? Like, you just, the end judge that I ended up seeing was, like, at the day of my sentence, I was like, yo, I don't speak Spanish. I don't, you know what I mean? I was a Marine. He was all like, basically, like, my question was, like, I have all this and there's nothing I could do. He's all like, well, the bottom line is you're Mexican and you're a felon, so you got to get deported.
This underlying theme of your citizenship and your superpower of timing came back to haunt you.
Right.
So this whole time growing up in elementary school, middle school, high school, some college, joining the Marines, you were culturally American. You spoke English. You even have an accent like you're from the Northeast, because you are from the Northeast.
Right.
So the gravity of the situation starts to wear on you, and you realize that you're getting deported to one of the most dangerous places on earth, and that's Ciudad Juarez. And at the time when you get deported, you don't have any connections to your family, correct?
Well, I you know what? I wasn't getting deported to Ciudad Juarez. They left me in Acuña. I mean, I could have went to any place.
But you went from Acuña to Juarez.
Yeah, I can't. I had to come to Juarez because it was the closest I had to, like, family. Yeah. My family was in El Paso. My biological mother was in El Paso. I didn't really have any other choice.
So what year did you get deported?
I got deported in 2009.
So around 2009, that's around the surge in violence in Juarez. They're getting thousands of murders from the drug war, right?
Right.
Okay,
yeah,
so
pretty bad. It was. But I mean, they left me in Acuña. I had to take the bus over here. I had like $80 in my pocket. I was homeless. I didn't have any family here. I didn't know nobody here. You know what I mean? Like, it was hard. It was.
What did the guard tell you when you were crossing the fence into Mexico? Did you?
He said, "Good luck and don't come back." Good luck, don't come back. I was like, got it.
So you're on the bus, right? And you had to Juarez. Where did you end up living? Like, how did you find your living circumstance under your feet? Like,
okay. Well, my girlfriend at the time, when I got out of prison, her family was from Juarez. Right. So she picks me up at the bus station and she's like, yo, why don't you stay at a hotel? I was like, I got $80 in my pocket. I don't have money for like a Holiday Inn or something. So, we found a place where people rent rooms to go, you know, to go have sex. They go for, you know, like to rent the room for 3 hours or whatever. And so we pull up in that spot and the lady, I was like, how much for a room? She's all like, give me 200 pesos for, you know, 3 hours, or 150 pesos for 3 hours. I was like, I don't need it for 3 hours. I need it for the night. And she was all like, just give me 200 pesos a night and take that room in the corner. So basically I was staying there. You know, my girl had a life. She couldn't stay with me. I was just there by myself in this hotel, scared to death, didn't speak Spanish.
What part of the city was this?
This is just the like central part of the city. It wasn't the worst part, but it's not the best part. You know what I mean?
It was a very contested neighborhood. Yeah.
Right. But then, so my girl was asking around while I was staying here, and she's asking around over there. And one of her friends had I guess she had family here who had an apartment for rent. I rented an apartment for $100 a month. Now, you get what you pay for. It was like a cinder block with paint on it. It would get so cold in the winter, like you could see your breath. How, you know what I mean? It was hot in the summer. It was a dangerous part of the city.
What was the neighborhood?
It's called Bella Vista. It's right next to, it's not far from the downtown bridge, the downtown
Santa Fe Bridge. But you could see your apartment, your old apartment.
I can see my old neighborhood. I can see the point, like the roof of my old apartment that I had in El Paso. I can see it from my new apartment in Juarez. Like out of my bedroom window, I could see the Wells Fargo banks from El Paso, man. It was driving me crazy. You know what I mean? It's not just being a deported veteran, but just people in general that are deported. It's hard not to think about going back because you had your whole life over there. So Anyway, so I had the apartment for $100 a month. I didn't have any furniture. So all I had, one of the neighbors over there, they lent me an air mattress. So I had an air mattress and I had two milk cartons, one to sit on, one to eat on. And then I would stack them up and put this little TV on. And then with the TV, I couldn't get any English channels because when they did the digital switch, I didn't speak Spanish. I was literally going crazy. I was losing my mind, man. I was like situational depression, to say the least, suicidal thoughts, man. It was like just the worst. A lot of deported vets aren't going to admit it, but every single one of us has had suicidal thoughts. Not everybody's open about it because, you know, they're just afraid to talk about it or whatever, but it was bad. It was really bad.
So you're less than 10 miles away from William Beaumont, which is the VA hospital, the Veterans Affairs Hospital in El Paso, Texas, in the Northeast.
Sure.
You couldn't get access to any of the mental health doctors or the ER benefits that you've earned, right? Because you're deported.
Okay. That's been a problem. Not just mental health. Like, I got underlying health stuff that I need to check out that I just don't have the money for. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I can't go to the VA hospital. And I mean, there's this thing called the foreign medical program, but it's hard to find a doctor that's going to wait that long to get paid. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the VA is going to drag their feet. If the doctor agrees to it, he's not going to get paid for a couple of months. There's not too many people here in Mexico that's going to do that. This is going to give you health care.
So I remember a story. I hope you'd be willing to share it, because I think our people need to know about it. Your encounter corruption with police one evening when you're walking back from the border. You remember what I'm talking about?
Where they strip me down naked?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, gentlemen. I'm just going to interrupt really quick. We are over time. So I've been sending you text messages, but that's fine. But I want to wrap it up so that you feel you at least had this time to talk. So finish your story.
Okay.
And then say goodbye. And remember, you can always book another time to continue your conversation.
That was just the part. That was just part one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's important that you end with this part, this story of corruption, just to give a little glimpse of what it was like.
Well, I remember. Okay, my friend came over to watch the Cowboys game with us, and. Like, I was walking him home, and the bridge is only three blocks from my house. And before I left the house, I made sure I didn't have any money in my wallet or anything. I just carried my ID. I walked into the bridge, walked back. It was like 9 o'clock at night. Police stopped me. They're like, "What are you doing out here?" And I was like, "I'm walking home." They're like, "Well, we got a report." They always say this. "We got a report of somebody robbing houses." Like, I got a tank top and shorts on. I didn't rob anybody. And they stripped me down naked in front of all the neighbors, stripped me down naked, went through my wallet, just basically police harassment. But I mean, I've seen the craziest stuff since I've seen dead bodies, you know, like been close to like gunshots where I used to live. I used to hear gunshots almost every night. It's just, you know, being deported has been a challenge, to say the least.
Yeah, you're deported to a war zone.
Yeah, it hasn't been the easiest. But you know, we maybe get another time for this, for the rest of it.
Yeah, but thank you for your service. Yeah.
Thank you for yours, brother.
Yeah, nah, bro. Like, everything you go through, this is what you're like. You know what I mean? It's disgusting how we treat you guys.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, bro, keep your head up. I'll stop by with some Whataburger.
All right. Thanks, man.